Some people who object to the idea that George Washington was a Christian make a big deal about his commitment or supposed commitment to the Masons. Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our guest right now is a returning guest, Dr. Peter Lilback. He and I wrote the book that thankfully was a bestseller, a national bestseller, called George Washington's Sacred Fire. Dr. Lilback, so great to have you back on the program.
Jerry, it's a pleasure, and I look forward to talking to you about this very interesting topic.
All right, George Washington and the Masons. Did George Washington's masonry, or his commitment as a Mason, did that in any way disqualify the claim that he was a Christian? What are your thoughts, sir?
Well, you know, when I started working on this project many years ago and got serious about it, and started to see evidence of what looked like maybe a Christian George Washington, just from his statements and writings, I came across the fact that he had been a member of the Masonic Order, and suddenly I realized I was going to have a problem, because there are at least a very large number of evangelical people who say the Masonic Order is anti-Christ in its salvation teachings, and actually wants to take us away from biblical Christianity. And I thought, oh boy, I don't know how I'm going to deal with that, because the evidence is clear that he was in fact a Mason. He was painted with Masonic regalia. There's a gigantic monument to the Masonic Order in Alexandria, Virginia, that celebrates Washington as a Mason. So you can't run from that fact. So as I wrestled with that issue, I began to look at different things. And the first real breakthrough of my understanding came when I was in the Boston Athenaeum, which is a wonderful rare book room up in, obviously, Boston, that has most of George Washington's original library. It's fascinating. It got sold, it got shipped around, but much of it ended up in a private collection there in Boston.
Hmm.
And when I went into it, I discovered that there were a series of volumes that had been bound together, and they were called sermons. And I said, my goodness, George Washington read sermons. He was a sermon collector. I later discovered that it was part of their family practice on the Lord's Day afternoon that George would read to Martha, his wife, a sermon that they had received in, through some means in the last previous weeks. So that was part of their devotional life. But as I was looking at these bound together sermons, there was one that said on the edge of the bound book, Masonic sermons. And I said, Masonic sermons? What? I didn't know they had sermons in the Masonic Order. And so I started looking, and I discovered that it was the practice of many of the Masonic groups in the United States at this early time in history, on what was called St. John's Day, to have a minister of the gospel come in and preach. And I began to look at the preachers, and I discovered that these were the great gospel preachers of the United States in these early era that had sermons in there. So I started reading them, and one of them that really got my attention said something like this: I'm preaching today to a group of Masons, and just to remind us that we are Christian Masons, I want to quote from the bylaws of this Masonic fraternity. And then right in the text it says this: because we are Christian Masons, no stupid atheist or deist may be a member.
Oh, wow.
Let me put end of quote on that. I didn't say that word stupid. That's right out of their bylaws. And I said, if ever I wanted to see that there's a reality of Christian masonry and it could not be identified with the deistic or an atheist variety, there it was, right before my very eyes, and their own bylaws. And so I read other sermons, but perhaps the one that I loved the best was one that where a preacher was preaching to a group of Masons, and it went something like this. Some of you think you're going to get into heaven because at some point in your life you have worn the robes of Martin Luther. I assure you, those will not get you into heaven. He said, some of you think you're going to get into glory because you have worn the robes of John Calvin. Be assured, these will not get you into heaven. And they said, and many of you think you're going to get into heaven because you've worn the apron of a Mason. Be assured, this will not get you into heaven. And then he said, if you hope to enter into the eternal glory of heaven, you must be clothed in the righteousness of Jesus Christ, received by faith alone. I was utterly stunned. I said, I could preach that in my own pulpit. Yeah. It's beautiful. And then I realized that there was something called Christian Masonry going on in America. I came across then a Masonic encyclopedia, and one of its entries had Christian Masonry. And as I read the entry, it said, it is a reality that wherever Christianity goes, it Christianizes. And the Masonic order, which may not be necessarily Christian in character, has a Christian expression in places where Christianity exists. I said, aha, even they are willing to admit it. And maybe the most interesting fact I came across had to do with a man named Charles Thompson, actually right from Bryn Mawr, where I pastored for many years. There's what's called the Harriton High School. It's right on the Harriton farm that Charles Thompson used to own. He was the only clerk the Continental Congress ever had. And in a biography of his life, there were several entries of letters that were part of his life. And one of them actually came from a Masonic fraternity in Pennsylvania. They were writing to Charles Thompson because he was a well-known Presbyterian elder, a classicist. Actually, some of the mottos that we have in America, like E Pluribus Unum and Annuit Coeptus and Novus Ordo Seclorum, those were recommended by the classic knowledge of Charles Thompson. Hmm. But the letter that was written from the Masonic group to him said, "Dear Mr. Thompson, our Masonic fellowship is beginning to lose its Christian testimony.
Whoa.
We are deeply in need of Christian members. And so we are writing to you, asking you, as a Christian gentleman, to join our fellowship to keep our Christian testimony clear." Okay, and I thought, isn't that amazing? That's what we have seen all throughout history. Groups that have at one time had a Christian testimony begin to lose their faith. And that's what has happened to many. I can't say for all, but at least the Masonic order that many know has no Christian testimony, but once it did. And so a good example in Philadelphia is a man by the name of John Wanamaker. There's actually a statue to John Wanamaker right outside the City Hall in Philadelphia, and it just calls him a citizen. But John Wanamaker was a Presbyterian elder, a deeply evangelical leader. He's the father of commercial retail sales. So when you go into a store and you see the price laying out and you evaluate, he designed what is used as retail sales all across America. He's the founding. And there used to be the Wanamaker stores. In his recommendation to a young man, he says, "I want you to know, if you want to be a success in your life, you need to be a Christian. You need to be a moral person. I recommend you not drink alcohol because it will potentially endanger your witness. And you ought to become a Mason. This will help you to become a better citizen." I said, this doesn't make any sense to me. But what it does show then, that for at least part of American history, to be a Mason could actually be argued as a testimony that you claim to be a Christian. That doesn't mean it's true today. I'm not a Mason. I've never been to a Masonic meeting. I don't recommend anyone to go to one, and I don't intend to become one. But as a historian, looking at these facts, I recognize that being a Mason in and of itself at that point in time did not mean you were not a Christian. Now, finally.
Wait, excuse me. I'm sorry. Before you get to the finally, what decade roughly are you talking about with the Wanamaker quote, John Wanamaker, about?
John Wanamaker would have been in the later 1800s.
Later 1800s? Oh, yep. Really? Oh, wow. Interesting, because yep. I thought the controversy happened maybe more around the 1830s. But go ahead, finally. You were going to say.
So what the point is that the controversy does come up earlier, but there's clearly examples of Christian Masonry that exists much later.
Okay,
now what's interesting is that in Washington's case, he indicates that, you know, there's a few letters that he wrote to Masonic people and that sort of thing. But someone wrote to him a book that had, I think it was a Reverend Snyder, if I remember correctly. And he said, "I've come across this book about the Illuminati and how they are invading and using the Masonic order to do all sorts of things." And Washington writes back and says, "I want you to know I've rarely been in a Masonic meeting in the last many years. I've been too busy to participate. But he says, I have never met one of those nefarious Illuminati members in any of the Masonic order meetings that I have attended.
Wow.
And he actually makes it clear that this penetration of the Illuminati, unbelieving, atheistic variety Masonic integration, it was not something that was his experience. He makes it clear that's not the case. So I would humbly submit that Washington cannot be argued to be not a Christian because of his Masonic connection. In fact, it might be argued that in his day, it could actually be a testimony that he was. And humorously, and you may remember this, we at the end of our book, Jerry, we talk about the revenge of Parson Weems.
Yes.
Parson Weems was the local Anglican/Episcopal minister in Virginia that wrote the first biography of Washington, getting all those local stories about the cherry tree and
yes.
the things that people say could never have happened. But we need to understand that Washington knew Weems. They corresponded. Washington even endorsed one of his books, which is interesting. But Weems, who was known by others as a very clear evangelical minister who pastored for a while at Washington's own church in, at Pohick in Lorton, Virginia, he was an active, visible member of the Masonic Order as a well-known evangelical minister. So at least in some circles, there was no problem. And I keep saying finally, but I'm really on a roll, Jerry. Forgive me.
I've thought
of another thing. Yeah, there's a great Presbyterian minister named Samuel Miller, a great Reformed Presbyterian preacher from New York City. His works are still read to this day, and he had a hand in founding the original Princeton Seminary. And it's interesting that one of the sermons that were preached in the Masonic Hall was by none other than this Reverend Miller. So, in other words, here was a very devout Reformed pastor who actually provided a Masonic sermon. So it shows that they were much closer, at least at one point in history. So I would say, guess what? Being a Mason back then actually was an argument that Washington was a Christian rather than a deist.
So then basically what's happening is another example of historical anachronism or something, where we're basically reading into George Washington's modest participation in Masonry, because as you mentioned one of those letters, in fact, I remember Eidsmo put it this way, John Eidsmo, author of Christianity and the Constitution, he said that Washington, over a state of four decades, attended probably one meeting per decade. So that doesn't show, you know, a major commitment to the Masonry at the time. But basically what you're saying is in the days of George Washington, Masonry was not this hotbed of unbelief. Some Right. could argue that all that came later. That's why I was kind of fascinated in that John Wanamaker quote, because I heard that some of the big controversy started to brew, saying around the 1830s. And so
That there were already different expressions going on. But I would like to give a simple example. Historically, you can do what's sometimes called an anachronism, where you take
yeah.
something that's out of historical order and introduce it at the wrong time. Sometimes you can call it guilt by association. So if someone says, well, my grandfather came from Russia, you could say, oh, he must have been a communist, right? You say, no, he left before the revolution. He was actually an Orthodox priest under the Tsar. So you need to know the history, right?
Exactly.
And so just because a person is in a movement doesn't mean it's the worst expression of that movement or it has a particular – you have to understand each person in their historical context. So you and I have often talked about how Washington has been ripped out of his historical context.
Exactly.
And we must not let that happen. And this would be an example where that could easily occur.
All right. Dr. Peter Lobeck, thanks so much for joining us. Providenceforum.org for more information. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.